The unsurpassed, penetrating, and perfect truth is seldom met with, even in 100,000 myriad kalpas. Now we can see and hear it. We can remember and accept it. I vow to make the Buddha's truth one with myself. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha. Some of you probably share with me the curse of having snippets of music repeat over and over again through your head. And usually they're schlocky pop songs or some silly piece of lyric. And it can go on for weeks, at least in my case, it can go on for weeks. And often it's a love song, and I wonder, what's the celibate monk doing with a love song going through her head? So in pure self-defense, I began to wonder if perhaps the particular words that were repeating over and over again in my head were there for a reason, and perhaps they had a message for me. And that perhaps if I looked and paid attention to the message, some good would come of all of this suffering. So the last few weeks, there's been a pop song in my head, I think from the 60s or the 70s, and some of you will recognize the lyrics. And I may not have them quite right, but what I remember is, there's a kind of a hush all over the world tonight. All over the world, you can hear the sound of lovers in love. Now, I'd sing it, but that would be embarrassing. So, so when I looked at these words, you know, again, I'm thinking, why me? I look at these words, and the first thing that struck me was the word hush. There's a kind of a hush all over the world tonight. Hush, quiet, silence, stillness. That didn't sound too bad. And then I noticed the intimacy, lovers in love, a kind of non-dual intimacy, if you will, the repetition of the word love, love loving. In a similar vein, I was struck once by a novel I was reading. An 80-year-old man who lived alone in New York City in a little apartment in Manhattan all of his adult life, 55 years, and very lonely. At dusk on a summer's evening, you know, dusk is late on a summer's evening and the light is long. He's reflecting on all those as the light recedes into darkness, who are moving together towards each other for love and comfort. Having put down the day's busyness, this is the time for intimacy. And he describes it as fingers flickering on bare shoulders all over New York City. And I was struck by this word flickering because it suggests that intimacy has a kind of tentativeness to it. Tentativeness to it, and an exploratory quality. Now, maybe it's a measure of my own self-centeredness that I had never considered humankind at a certain time of day en masse moving towards engagement with each other, towards sex, towards love, towards intimacy. It's a delightful thought. Everyone, or many of us, from the North Pole to the South Pole, along a line of longitude, opening to each other, and that line moving slowly around the planet in a quiet wave. As the day quietens and the dusk falls, darkness falls. So this alone intimacy is actually done together, in stillness, tentatively, exploring. I've had more than one monk who chose to disrobe say to me that they want to have some intimacy, some connection in their lives, as if monastic life precluded that. So during a tea at Throssell, our monastery in England, when I was visiting there, We were talking about monks' relationships to each other, to the laity, the role of friendship in a monk's life with each other, with the laity, and the conversation was coming down on the side of distance. And I had an instinct to redress that, so I said, "What about intimacy? What about connection?" And the abbot, Reverend Master Daishin Morgan, shot back, "Connection is now." Well, that stopped me in my tracks. When else was it going to be, you know, when I had the right conditions, the right people, the people I liked, the people I felt connected to? Really, connection depended on the quality of my presence right now and on nothing else, really. So when is it ever not here? And if it's not, there's something I can do about it, yeah? So there's something here to be said about celibacy. And this isn't just for monks, because I know that it's not altogether rare for a lay person to actually choose to be celibate, not by default, you know, because they can't find someone to love them, but because they see that for them at certain times in their lives, it's something that's good to do for various, very good reasons, actually. And we may tend to think that someone who is celibate is like a dried up old prune, you know, cold and distant and rigid and shut down and bitchy and cranky and all those sorts of things. And I'm hoping that the monks in this monastery stand as a counterexample to that. Stereotype, thank you, of how we might think that a celibate person would be. I'm hoping we stand as a counterexample. But you know, there's this lovely quote from Dogen that we hear so often from the Genjo Kyokan. To study Buddhism is to study the self. To study the self is to forget the self. To forget the self is to be enlightened by the whole world. It's one of my favorites. And I think we can apply that to celibacy. Something like, to choose celibacy, to let go of sexual paired love, is to love the whole world. You forget the self, you're enlightened by all things. Choose celibacy and you love the whole world. So choosing celibacy isn't a shutting down, but an opening to the whole universe. And in celibacy, when you don't actually need anything from anyone or anything, is the possibility of being intimate with all beings and all things. So, please don't get the wrong idea. Not to choose celibacy is not a shutting down either. And there's nothing wrong with either choice. For those for whom the path is to be sexually engaged, they can also be intimate with all beings and all things. So don't get caught in the opposites here. I just wanted to put a little plug in for celibacy. Now, suffering is a denial of intimacy. There's that wonderful definition of suffering that many of you will have heard before: wanting things to be other than they are. Wanting things to be other than they are, that's the opposite of intimacy, isn't it? Because we're not actually willing to be engaged with what's present. Not wanting what is here, pushing it away, rejecting it. If instead this very moment were sufficient, intimacy wouldn't be a problem, would it? So what supports or enables intimacy? As I've just somewhat suggested, listening, clear seeing, being willing to be with what is, those things all support intimacy. Those things are familiar to us from our practice. Not turning away, non-rejection, and detachment. Attachment is the cause of suffering, right? Second noble truth. First noble truth, suffering exists. Second noble truth, cause of suffering is attachment. And detachment is the way to the end of suffering. The near enemy of detachment is indifference. A near enemy is one of my favorite concepts, and I came across it from the Theravada Buddhists. A near enemy is something that looks like a thing, but isn't it, and actually undermines the thing. So I just said the near enemy of detachment is indifference. So indifference looks like detachment, but in fact, indifference is based in delusion, and it undermines detachment. It appears to support it or to be it, but that's not it. So if we're indifferent, we're not actually detached. Detachment is something else. And indifference is definitely not intimacy. And if I'm making the claim that detachment is intimacy, the near enemy of intimacy is attachment, right? Attachment can look like love, caring, connection, intimacy, but it actually isn't. Attachment precludes intimacy because there's something we want and something we're trying to hold on to, and we're creating suffering. When we're attached, it's impossible to know another for who they are and what they are. We're not really seeing them. We only see them for our own purposes in terms of what they can do for us. Now, that's putting it a bit harshly, but that's what's behind it. And detachment, on the other hand, is over and over again letting go. This coming back to this incessant instruction we're given to let go of what we think we know so that we can just see and just hear. Now, the far enemy is kind of like the opposite. It's the thing that's distant from a thing and is the real enemy. The far enemy of intimacy is rejection and aversion. Not revulsion, but rejection. Because we can be repulsed by something and not reject it. Now, the real tool for intimacy, for supporting intimacy in our lives, is awareness. Awareness is the sine qua non of intimacy. In fact, you could say that awareness is intimacy. If we're simply living in awareness, we're already intimate and connected. And awareness is something we always have with us. We say the nature of the mind is pure, bright awareness. How can we not have the nature of our minds with us? It's always there. Ajahn Sumedho, in his book, Don't Take Your Life Personally, which is a book that I quite like, equates awareness or awakenedness, he uses both words, awakenedness, with nirvana. Now that's kind of interesting and radical, isn't it? He says that awareness is the unconditioned, the unborn, the release from suffering, nirvana itself. And I think he's right. So I'd like you to hear what an excerpt from a book that Jack Kornfield and Christina Feldman, who are two Vipassana teachers, Theravadan teachers, they compiled a collection of teaching stories from various religious traditions, actually, but which have Buddhist teaching embedded in them. It's a book called Soul Food. And in their introduction to the section on compassion, they write, "We hold within ourselves an extraordinarily precious gift, our capacity to be aware. This is the blessing that allows us to make choices, to sense the possibilities open to us. It empowers us to learn and grow through life's tests rather than be swallowed up by them. The gift of our awareness allows us to nurture our capacities for forgiveness and understanding rather than being driven by self-protective instincts, hostility, and fear. And they go on. We have not yet plumbed the depths and possibilities of our own awareness. How close can we come to another person? How deeply can we feel the wind that seems only to brush us with its touch? How attuned can we be to the changing rhythms of our universe? What is the extent of freedom? The only thing that is certain about awareness is that it removes all distance. It shatters mistaken notions and superficiality. It connects us with the heart of all life. It allows us to meet the tests in our life with greatness of heart. So I would submit that awareness is intimacy itself. It supports so much which supports intimacy. To sense possibility, to forgive and understand, to release fear and hostility, to know things as they are, to remove all distance. It enables us to connect with all that is. It is the connection. It enables us to deeply feel the breeze that brushes our cheek. And isn't that, or maybe I should say it, that isn't that anything other than what we do in meditation? To sit within that which is, holding the question, what is it? Without actually needing an answer. The question which doesn't judge or criticize, doesn't stereotype, doesn't presuppose, doesn't make assumptions about, but simply is in the middle of what is, listening. So all of us have this possibility of knowing the wind on our cheeks. I would like to suggest that the wind also knows us. What if, instead of thinking of the universe as mechanistic matter, we were to experience it as alive and intelligent and creative, as imbued with meaning and purpose, ensouled, if you will, forgive me for putting it that way, imbued with the numinous, having a divine spark to it, having the capacity to know. Perhaps it isn't that way, but the mechanistic view of the universe has led us to where we are, which has its problems, and this other hypothesis seems to me to lead us somewhere more wonderful. But I'll leave that to each of you. I prefer this way of construing it because it leads, I think, to so much more good. And I think, too, that this is what Dogen meant when he said, not all things have Buddha nature, but all things are Buddha nature. So what if the wind is feeling us, too, and knowing us, too? What if it isn't just me who experiences the wind, a self engaged with an object? What if the wind and I are co-creating a universe? Now, one of the dangers of meditation practice, and all spiritual practice is dangerous at some level, is that within our meditation practice, we can too readily view it as a subject experiencing an object. And you'll hear this when we give meditation instruction, we can say things that are reasonable to say, like, I'm sitting here knowing, seeing, watching, My thoughts, feelings, memories, emotions arise and pass away. I'm just sitting here. They're arising and passing away. I'm seeing them. I'm here and they're there and I'm watching them and not reacting. This is a very common way to describe what we do in our meditation practice. But what's dangerous about it is that it can make it appear that there's an opposition of subject and object. There's a subject watching an object, my thoughts, my emotions. Opposition is adversarial. And that's not intimacy. So to be a subject aware of an object completely obliterates any possibility of awareness with a capital A being nirvana. Awareness with a capital A is more like awaring. Being. And the awaring is intimacy. In my view, the most important teaching of Buddhism is the teaching of non-duality. And the separation of subject and object is a perfect description of duality. And further, separation is the grand delusion. That we think we're separate from each other and from the unborn is the fundamental delusion within which all other delusions lie. To see ourselves as observers observing something other than ourselves, which is to objectify, which is really to abuse, or at least to use. It's interesting to me that the word use is in the word abuse. What if instead of using the universe, we were to suffuse the universe? Again, the word use in the word suffuse. What if we were to suffuse the universe? What if we do suffuse the universe? What if the universe suffuses us? What if the wind and I are experiencing each other and we're not really two different things? What if the wind is inside of me and I am inside of it? This is actually much closer to the truth of things. We are mutually aware of each other or mutually awaring each other, and this changes both of us. Just sitting with each other, being each other, knowing each other, and that's knowing with a capital K, not the small k knowing of the intellect. This is our true meditation practice within the meditation hall of non-duality. Just sitting within each other, being each other, knowing each other. Our true meditation practice within the hall of non-duality. Now, to radically enter non-duality, we must ask ourselves, what if we didn't need to protect our own survival? What if we trusted our own death? Wouldn't this be the end of division, strife, warfare, the misuse of the world, the need to protect something for ourselves? And the beginning of intimacy and connection beyond our wildest dreams. It takes a real leap to let go of our need to protect our own survival. It takes a phenomenal level of trust. But isn't that exactly what would be of help? And to do this meditation practice, it is essential to be very, very quiet and stop wanting and needing. Actually, stillness is only possible if we stop wanting and needing. So in stillness, tentatively at first, it becomes a rushing torrent. At dusk, when the day is still, all over the world tonight, we can hear the sound of beings coming together to meditate. Lovers in love. Us and the universe in love with each other. Connection is here. Connection is now. So you see, all things teach, even crazy pop songs. Homage to the Buddha, homage to the Dharma, homage to the Sangha.